You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Judy Glansman. She is an artist that lives and works in New York City, is represented by Betty Cunningham Gallery, and has shown work all over the world, has quite an illustrious career, has won numerous awards and grants, notably the Guggenheim Memorial Fellowship, Anonymous Was a Woman, Pollock Krasner, and several others. Judy, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
What's happening in your studio now? I want to talk about your work and a number of the shows you have, but what are you working on at the moment?
Well, about 4 years ago, I call it the War Series, but it really is a kind of a reflection of somehow feeling that we're involved in, well, I guess it started with my seeing the Guernica, and then I decided that I would try to use my work to find a way, a language, to talk about how it feels to be engaged in things but not reflective in your daily life. And so because I opened the door to saying what would these things look like, I started to use collage. I started to go back to looking at observation because I needed to see what a gun looked like and try to find sort of things in the world that kind of spoke to me about war, and also started looking at, I always loved Goya, but I started to really study a book that a friend gave me of all these washes that he did in preparation for various things, disasters of war, you know, a couple of the series. So now that I did a show in Betty in April with that work, and so now in my studio I'm trying to use the same method, which is basically sort of three-tiered. So I do these big collages and I do these little paper-mounted on canvas paintings, and also things from observation. And I've started to work from the Winslow Homer. I have to look at the name of the painting. So I'm kind of trying to use the same method but encompass everything. In other words, you know, not limited to horror and terror, but hopefully including beauty and all kinds of feelings in the work. So that's basically, it's kind of a madhouse in here. It's just like a three-ring circus. Let's see, the name of the painting is Dressing for the Carnival by Winslow Homer. So those are my sort of three activities that I do at once.
And that's a powerful, that sounds like a very powerful series. I've seen the images, of course, from Betty Cunningham. And, you know, you mentioned Guernica and Goya, and both of those painters created work that was so, as I see it, you know, political. That was, you know, the Guernica, when I first saw that as a teenager with my parents in Spain, I remember it was behind bulletproof glass at that point. And it was, you know, thought of as being, you know, in danger of being damaged or destroyed by people who didn't like that. And for the first time in my life, as I remember, I saw art that was, that was truly political, or seemed to be, to not be about aesthetics nearly as much as about a particular political situation. You talked about your work as not being somehow reflective in daily life, and I didn't quite understand that. And so what I'm trying to say is, how does that relate to Guernica or Goya, in the sense that that work seemed to be, to my mind, and maybe I'm incorrect, but that seemed to me to be almost activist work about that. And I see your work in that vein too, but I'm wondering why you mentioned something about not being reflective about it in daily life.
What I meant was, and I think for me, it was a way of thinking of this work in relationship to earlier work that I'd done that was really coming out of a kind of psychology and a kind of interior personal expression, that my relationship to war in a daily way is that we don't feel it at all. In other words, there's a kind of a sense that this thing is going on out there and isn't really affecting how I go to the market, what I do, you know, how I get up in the morning. And it reminds me certainly of the AIDS crisis, when you, friends of yours were in a, you know, affected by a plague, but everybody else acted like everything was okay. And it was very, you know, it was kind of like a comfort of daily life, which was an extreme contrast to how my experience of people I know, or even in terms of the Holocaust, that this is a, you know, life went on as normal, but a parallel life was going on underneath. And I guess I felt, so when I talk about daily life, I was meaning that in our daily life, we don't feel any of the effects. And then when I saw the Guernica, you know, that's such a domestic scene. And I really was struck by that, that the kind of imagery that he was conjuring wasn't foreign imagery. It was imagery that was very relevant to everybody. Everybody, you know, everybody has that light bulb going on. It's a kind of a domestic setting in a way. It's a kind of a house. And but for me, the relationship that I had to war, you know, I really knew underneath. I didn't want to describe a battle. I didn't want to talk about things that I didn't know about. So what was my experience of war? My experience of war was one in which it really wasn't, I didn't go to war. I'm not a soldier. It was even almost kind of a, you know, hubris to think I could talk about it. And somebody came to the show and asked me, are you very political? And I think that my relationship to politics is just, you know, I'm 57 years old and I've lived in this world a long time. And the political things that, not only being an artist, I think, in a sense, living the life of an artist is political, but the idea that you somehow, you know, you're political if you just pay attention and you see things changing in ways you didn't expect them to change. It's things that you presumed to be true suddenly became up for grabs. And so I think that all those things kind of brought me to a way of looking, but it really was a kind of the idea for me, the access was, how can I develop a language that I really didn't know about to try to describe something which was just a kind of a feeling? And the feeling wasn't the, you know, traditional notions of war. It was more of a kind of a sense that there were things going on, but they were kind of underneath the surface.
And how did the show at Betty Cunningham go? We were just talking a little bit about Betty Cunningham before we began recording the interview, and we're discussing how wonderful it is to have somebody like Betty, you know, working with you. And your work in that show and in general is not easy work, I would imagine, to collect for people or to understand. And Betty, having shown that work, is, you know, is really admirable, and you making it. How was it received? And beside the conversation that you just mentioned about someone asking if you were political, how was that show received, and what conversations did that generate?
Well, you know, it was really amazing. It actually, and I spent a lot of time in the gallery. It was my first show where I really had a visual image of not just the work that I was making, but the show itself, a kind of continuity. And the show was, it was definitely very energetic and raw, and had a feeling almost like you would just kind of like walk into my studio. There was something, I guess I wanted to show my thinking process, that the relationship between art making and thinking is really, you know, want that to be as connected as possible. And generally people were really incredibly enthusiastic. I mean, there were some moments that were, first of all, there was a lot of work in it, and a lot of the work wasn't that expensive, so it was very viable for people to buy. It was really great in that way. There was a man and a woman. He was a police officer, and she was a judge from Lebanon, and they came in, and they bought a big gun piece, and things like that happened. In other words, that it was a very powerful thing for me that people that responded to the work were not necessarily people involved in the art world. And the other thing is, there's a thing on YouTube where, Grace Gros-Pillard came in, and she sometimes does videos, and you hear her gasp when she walks in. And I think the sense not only was that it was a surprise in terms of my work, but also that the work, if you wanted to engage in it, it was very enveloping. In a way, I think I'm kind of a, you know, unrelenting. And artwork is unrelenting. And the other thing about Betty was she allowed me, you know, her sensibility, I think, is much more austere. But she allowed me to do exactly what I needed to do, which was basically to kind of create a kind of an experience in there. And you're right. Some people, it seemed, walked in and just could not tolerate it. And I think that it kind of pounded at you in a certain way. But there's a lot of beauty and grace in the quality of drawing and in the building of things, and it certainly relates, you know, to art history. And one of the reviews was written by Peter Plagian, so that really meant a lot to me. And he said that he begins the thing by saying that it's a terrible show, and then sort of follows through by saying, you know, very positive things. But he describes it being kind of like student work, and even being kind of mawkish. And I think that's true of me in the sense I feel like, you know, in thinking of this interview, I keep feeling like I'm a student right now in the best sense, that I can just kind of, that there's a kind of real curiosity, that I don't know what's going to happen, that I can use the sort of the tools that I've developed in order to make the work, but that the quality of the work is not known to me. So if that to me is a kind of a student of my own work. And so I think it was received really well. I mean, as far as, you know, it's certainly raw, and a lot of the pieces are just like torn paper. So it's always kind of interesting because I think with me, my work has one leg in tradition and one leg in something that is, I don't know if you call it innovative or unusual in terms of art things. Some of the things, you know, I think, I don't know if this will make sense to you, but the idea that you could bring something, a piece of artwork, down to sort of sum zero. In other words, there's no gold leaf frame, there's no diamonds on it, there's no value to it extra. The only value is in the work. And that is an idea to somehow get to that point of something very practically indistinguishable between nothing and everything is something that I really care about, I'm trying to achieve. So sometimes that thing is hard for people to take. You know, it doesn't look, we didn't really have the money to frame everything. It didn't look polished. And that was something that I think is part of my sensibility and even out of, you know, my experience in East Village. I mean, that's sort of who I am.
Yeah, perhaps that's what, you know, Peter Plagans was alluding to in a sense that, to me, that is what's, you know, attractive about your work or particularly that show at Betty Cunningham, you know, the sense of the edges being left unfinished. And in so often now, it seems that what we see in the art world is very polished, finished work that looks like it's ready to go into a, you know, Hollywood mansion or something and doesn't have the kind of quality of even, you know, edges and, like you're saying, torn paper and, you know, what to some people may look finished or unfinished or difficult. It's hard to pin down what that actually means as it's a student work, but in the best sense, to me, that sounds like something that's growing, that's changing, that's learning, that's asking a lot of questions, that's not so much about a polished piece that looks like art with a capital A. What do you think just to expand a little bit on that, being a student in the best sense, is that what it means to you, similar to what I'm saying, this kind of not being so polished and having those rough edges? Do you think that's what that means, or is it something else?
You know, I'm not sure, because I think of somebody like Jason Rhodes, and certainly Jason Rhodes is not polished, and things are not framed, and they're not, I think it's actually something where you cross categories that people can tolerate it, because certainly things having raw or, what is it called, there's a certain new phrase for paintings that it's not marginal, but something like that, you know, that they're kind of provisional. And that's perfectly accepted. I think the collision of that with a kind of tradition is something that I think people find difficult. But I don't know what he meant by it, but I know that for me, it really, you know, there's another element, and that is that my experience or my background came out of a kind of abstract expressionist. So for me to even use a narrative to tell a story, even an image that I use, you know, either reproduce from a photograph or even representationally look at something and you can recognize it, all those things for me are actually doors that opened that I didn't even realize that I had preconceptions against. But in other words, that's not something I did. So I guess like I would think of the work as being all the things that I didn't do. You know what I mean? Like not only is it, when you said about things being polished, I think brand is more relevant. In other words, it doesn't look like something that looks like something that they understand as something, that it's already been kind of codified, put into a kind of a container. And hopefully that quality is something that's thrilling. I mean, sometimes I used to go down to the Philadelphia Museum and look at the Jasper Johns and try to imagine what I would feel like if I walked in and saw this thing and I didn't know it was Jasper Johns. And I think that would be something that you would feel. You would feel, looking at that work, you think, like, what the heck is this? What is this? And I think that that's something that you know, more than something that's marketable. I think something that seems surprising, and the notion of branding is the opposite of that. I mean, for me, I think that in our art world, there's a real, I mean, I guess since Warhol, like a kind of a blur between advertising and art. And it kind of like, so in other words, you don't really want to have something which challenges the way you look at something. You want to have something which sells you something, whether it's an idea or you're smart as a collector or, you know, willpower in terms of value. And I think those are things that for me, for whatever reason, I've never been able to really do. I mean, I don't know if you knew my work and you came to see the work that's in my studio now, if you would even know it was mine. And that's a very interesting thing for me as an artist. That's like really thrilling. But as a, in terms of career, I guess I would think that would probably be not a good idea. You know what I mean? You're better off branding something.
Well, I think to me that is what's exciting about your work and powerful, and the idea of asking questions continually and different types of questions and not being, you know, an artist that produces work that's predictable is what's very alive and about your work. I think that the notion of branding, while that certainly is seems to be talked about a lot and playing a lot, is a kind of box that's unfortunate, because I would like to think that art continually asks questions, and that's why everyone goes and looks at it, because whether it's conscious or not, we're learning about the world visually and politically and many other ways by just looking and understanding what it means to resolve questions that art raises that help us all understand.
The platitude is that they ask a question, now it gives you the answer. And I think that, you know, I don't mean to say that you can't, you know, you think of someone, you know, people always talk about Mirandi. I don't mean you have to change the form. I myself am interested in that or need to do that, question what the form is. But even in terms of a very narrow sense of what the form is, I think when you look at that Mirandi, he's also asking kind of a question. And the essential question is not what does something look like, but what I keep thinking about in art is how do you give a container for the things that are uncontainable, in other words, the ephemeral, the quality of things that are unnameable. You know, if you even think of them as kind of bowls, a container kind of or the touch, a kind of ephemeral quality that isn't really nameable, but it's actually the thing that's not nameable. So what art does is it kind of creates a kind of a, you know, parameters. And within those parameters, hopefully not only does it have the kind of materiality of its own self, but it contains something which is uncontainable, which is ephemeral, which is that other thing, you know.
Let's move back a little bit to your beginnings in art and developing really what is, as I see it, a very rich approach to your work. There's a lot of depth in what you're doing. It's something recently my wife and I have been talking about, work that seems to have a lot of layers to it, not physically, which often your work does, but simply depth. You know, there's an awful lot there to think about, to look at, to talk about. What first got you involved in art or the art world? It could be as a child or after school, wherever you want to start, but was there an early influence that made you think art was a very exciting world to be stepping into?
My mother's a painter. My father made work. My mother is not just a painter. She is like a believer in art. And I think that quality, even though until I was in 11th grade, I never would have thought that I was going to be an artist, but it was always around us. It was something. I have a really funny article. When we were little, we lived in Puerto Rico, and it's from the San Juan Star, and it says, like, you know, the painting from Glanzman's, the family that paints together stays together. So I think it was just basically in my blood, and I really do see how much my mother's influence and even ideas or qualities. I'm making collages now, and that's really basically she made collages. So I think that then the other real memories I have of influence is first seeing Modigliani, who I just, whatever reason, I just absolutely loved. It was Modigliani and Turner for some oddball reason that both kind of opened, you know, that showed me something that I didn't really, that attracted me. And then I went to RISD and actually married somebody 30 years later. Actually, we've been married for 20 years, but we got together about 20 years after RISD. And he and I both share kind of an interest in, I guess, like a kind of somewhere between humor, horrific, you know, and certainly gory would be like a kind of a threat. But I do feel, and this is a great feeling, that, you know, when you talk about layering, I'm about to go and work on a print, and so I try to think about literally layering things. And what I tried to describe before, which I don't know if it was clear or not, about the idea that as an artist, you really are sort of putting a placeholders for this other thing. But I think for me, layering, literally layering on top of things is something that kind of is, in other words, you could do it in a kind of a square, like a graphic thing, or you could do it in a spatial thing. And for me as an artist, in terms of depth, and I thank you very much, I feel like that's happened over a long period of time. So I feel like I'm one of those artists that as I get older, you know, when I was, what happened to me was that I started showing in the East Village, and it was a great thing, but certainly you could never say to somebody, go and do this. It wasn't prescribed because it was so crazily, you know, happenstance in a way. But I think aesthetically, I belong to that, a kind of group of people that had a kind of loose feeling and certainly an expressionist feeling about how to go about things and what they wanted to say. And then there was a long time in between. You know,
I want to talk a little bit about that. So that's after you got out of RISD, you moved to New York, and it was in East Village. You began showing in East Village. That was some of your first exhibits.
Well, what happened was that I grew up in New York since I was 13, and then I returned home and was sort of working in my little Christopher Street apartment, and I was waitressing. And then because I had some friends, they bought some paintings, and I went away to an artist retreat. And I never went to graduate school, but I really felt like working every day quietly away from everything was how I kind of developed my first, you know, I think of it as like my graduate school experience. And so when I returned, a girlfriend that I knew from school had an appointment that she wasn't able to keep up in the South Bronx at a place called Fashion Moda, run by Stefan Eins. And I kept the appointment. And basically what it meant was I took a giant tube of canvases on the subway to the South Bronx, which is a pretty funky place. And Stefan gave me my first show. Stefan, and just as an anecdote, the other person exhibiting was this guy, Anson Fino. And Anson's work was phosphorescent. In other words, you had to turn off the lights to see Anson's work. And so the whole show was turning those lights on and off. And so you had like my work and then you had his work. And it was just sort of typified the kind of anything goes feeling. And so after that, this guy, Dean Savard, who opened a gallery, Civilian Warfare, and was writing for the New York Native, he reviewed me and he asked me if I wanted to show in his gallery. And his gallery had Greer Langton, David Warnerovich, really wonderful, wonderful artists. And Dean and I had a kind of a real simpatico. So that was 1983. And, you know, it's just one of those things that it just kind of, we were in sync. And, you know, in terms of career stuff, I saw Hal Baum very recently, and I mentioned to him that the very same day that I received a rejection letter from his gallery for my slides, I had also sent him this invitation to Fashion Moda, which was much funkier. And he called me. I got the rejection letter and inclusion in the show on the same day. So it was really like finding your own way to, you know, speak to somebody. And that was really the beginning. And it was the thing is that the show at Hal led to my going down to the pier, which was on the water, and Spring Street, where David and Mike Bidlow had decided to do this, open up this abandoned pier and let any artist in. And that's how I started to meet a community of artists. It was a very, really wonderful thing. The pier was the most beautiful. It was very open. There was no sense of, there was no competition. Everybody was working together. And David had taken grass seeds and put them on the ground. And this pier was so, you know, it was so derelict that a lot of the ceiling was open. And so there was baby grass growing, a million artists working on the walls. It was a really spectacular time. And that was the beginning of my East Village showing.
Yeah, that was a very special time. You know, and interesting that also coincided with, you know, so much ultimately commercial activity later in the 80s. That show with David Warnerovich and the others you were saying, did you also have the sense that this is a very exciting group of artists that you're showing with? Was that a feeling that was kind of, was that group of artists also very, I don't know what the word is, but sympathetic to each other's work and to some extent supporting one another?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that was the feeling, and you knew it. And you knew it was magical. It was literally magical. And, you know, the quality of support was really awesome. I mean, I became close friends with David, but it really not until about 1986-87. But David was one of the people. David was a magical person anyway. But the feeling in that place was literally a feel, and I'm sure that other people, when they've experienced a kind of a movement happening, that it's the same feeling, because it was certainly beyond your individual self. It was a beautiful time of support, and definitely there was a kind of an anything goes playfulness. But when you said about the 80s, you know, it was kind of in reaction, I think, to sort of Soho's real emphasis on minimal work. But after that, I really think the end of the East Village, which really ended about 85, had to do with marketing, money, when things, competition, all the the opposite of what was the original spirit of the place. And that's just what happens, I guess, because, you know, it just changed sort of radically. But at that point in time, it was, and I think New York City at that time, the idea that you could sort of like, you know, pull back this metal thing and we all went through a little hole and then it opened up. And the first thing were these giant stairs. It was a kind of a, you know, beautiful building, really. And this guy, I think his name was David Finn, had taken garbage bags, but he'd made them into figures that were sitting along those stairs. So you knew it. Everybody knew it. Everybody. And it was very open. I mean, it was inclusive.
And so let's move forward a little bit, because that's, I want to talk a little bit about how things have changed, or what happens when a group like that or a scene like that ends to some degree, you know. So it's the late 80s now, and the East Village scene is ending, perhaps in a more in an economic way as well as a very real way. You know, artists are also dying. You know, that AIDS is taking a lot of amazing figures at that point. What was happening then for you in the late 80s, early 90s?
In the late 80s, early 90s, I was really poor. And I think I had kind of, in the beginning of the end, I think it was kind of shocking, because you just sort of thought like, oh, this is the way it's going to be. And the first thing that supplanted the East Village, or my experience, was really, you know, International with Monument. It was still happening down there, Pat Hearn. It was like just a different group. It was almost the pendulum swung to a kind of a much more postmodern kind of way of thinking. And, you know, wonderful artists came out of that. But I was not a part of that. But in the late 90s was a very, very difficult time. I mean, this was I was trying to sort of talk about that even in terms of the war series. So this was a time when you were just going to funerals. And when I found out that I went to Louisville, Kentucky with David and did a show, and that's when I really got closer to him. And then when he found out that his diagnosis, I really made an effort. I thought, I want to know him. And so over time, we David's boyfriend, Tom Rothenbach, you know, organized a small group of people, maybe there was four or five of us, that we kind of took watch, and we took care of David, and because that's what was needed. And I knew a number of people, beautiful people, who had the same thing, small group of people that would be counted on to keep watch, take care of that person. And so it was really a devastating time. I mean, it was just horrendous. I don't know how to, you know, say it any different. But you were spending time with somebody that was really, we just saw the Dallas Buyers Club with my daughter, and I was trying to tell her that, in a way, even when that movie starts, it's way into where it is. These people were beautiful, healthy, young, creative people, and before your eyes, you know, Mengele-type horror was happening to them. And you were very involved with the, you know, medical profession, because medical profession was basically saying to you, you make the choices. We don't really know it any more than you do. Here's the options. And it was striking that even though, that it was really Catholic hospitals that took care of those people. David was a Cabrini. Those nuns were just beautiful people to him. And politically, they were just at the, you know, such odds with one another. But it was very devastating. And actually, I have to say that my experience with David, you know, really made me acknowledge what matters to me and what a person of integrity is, because David just, he just couldn't help himself. That's who he was. And, so it was it was a very special time in that way, to have sort of, but as a young person, to experience, you know, the wasting of your friends, and no end, it just seemed like it wasn't going to ever get better, and there wasn't, you know, any hope at all. That was pretty harsh.
Yeah, that sounds devastating. And during that time, you know, you mentioned about getting to know David much more in that really kind of, you know, horrific but very intimate circumstance, and talked about, as you just said, his kind of integrity towards his own work and as a person. What was it that, I mean, if you can say in more detail, that you were learning about him as a person that I imagine was also influential in terms of how you were thinking about your work and life and what it means to be an artist?
Well, you know, the thing about David actually is that he was really funny. And, you know, he was also, like, incredibly articulate. I mean, when you know, I was there, David spent a lot of time at his kitchen table. And so with Donald Wildman, and they sued him for his sex series, and he was, he ended up winning this case. And there was a lot of controversy and a lot of news people calling. And he'd just sit at the table and kind of field these these calls from news media. And he was a person who, when he spoke, it was as if he had written it. I mean, he was a beautiful, in fact, his writing is so beautiful. I mean, he was very funny, even in terms of he was very, he had a low tolerance for, you know, bullshit, but he was very funny in terms of how sometimes he would see it. And then, you know, the other thing, well, there were a lot of elements of being an artist. Like, after David died, we went through a number of things, and you realize that every reference that he used in his work came from something. I mean, these were all studied, and, you know, the dung beetle that he used, he had, like, books on dung beetles. David loved nature, and he loved animals. And so, but he also, it was a kind of interesting thing, because when he developed dementia, suddenly David's rage, which I think had fueled him so powerfully, kind of dissipated. And every time, if for example, the Modern bought I think they bought all four of the elements, and we could tell David, and he wouldn't remember. You could tell him just a minute after, and every time he had a kind of delight, which is something that David, I think, as a healthy, before he got sick, was not able to. Everything made him, he had a kind of a, you know, he really was fueled by rage in a certain way. But he told me a funny anecdote. He did his, you know, the piece where he's the I am 600 pound. It's a talking piece that he did. He did it down in Philadelphia. He tells the story as he does his piece, and as he does it, his voice gets deeper and louder and louder. And what he's saying is scary. And at the end, there's silence in the room, and all of a sudden he hears, "Uh-oh!" And some little child is like, of the whole, like, it was like, wow, that guy went to the edge. David didn't hold back. He just couldn't. And I think that, as being an artist, you know, if you're going to do this thing, what the heck? You know what I mean? Like, you have to go all the way to the boundaries that you might set for yourself, you think that you presume should be set for you. For me, that doesn't really have that much validity, you know, that you have to kind of put everything you have into it. And that's certainly what David did, including his body. I mean, when he spoke or he did these talks, it was just he was that thing. I mean, so I guess, like, to have experience with somebody who is really, I tried to say it before, like, that it, you know, in contrast, say, to the War series, where I'm talking about two different realities coexisting, if you have no membrane between what you make, what you are, what you experience, like, that as an artist over time, you hope to be just a receptive, absolute, as receptive as you can. And that's and David was like that. He just was naturally took things in. In fact, he was kind of one of those people that kind of carried it with pain. You know, he was, as an artist, kind of a, I mean, I don't want to, you know, romanticize David, but he really was that thing. And, you know, he was like someone that could carry a lot of the negative things and then sort of reflect on them out as his work. So,
such a powerful experience, and I'm glad you shared that with us, because he was an extraordinary artist, and that sounds like such a powerful and extraordinary experience. After that decade, we're into the 90s, and you've gone through this extraordinary transition with friends like him and the kind of caring groups that, you know, were put together, the supportive groups, as people were wasting, were dying. What was the next step for you? What was the 90s like in terms of how you were exhibiting or continuing to make work?
Well, you know, I don't know if it was, when I was really poor, I had the studio out in Jersey City. And just when I can't remember if it was after David died or right before. It must have been after David died. I moved my studio back to the city, and I had my little apartment on Christopher Street so I could sort of have a roommate, make some, you know, like I was living pretty much on the edge, but I needed a studio, and I started to make these paintings. And someone else I really admire, Glenn Goldberg, who's a painter, he was my studio mate, and he said to me one day, the paintings are crying, because they were layers of Lindsay that would come through, and I was definitely painting the experience. And that those paintings were shown at Exit Art, a show called 1920, and then it was almost like night and day. Those paintings were shown. Irving Blum saw the work there. I started a show with Blum Hellman, and suddenly I was selling work again, and it was a, you know, it was a very different thing. But the thing about those paintings, which I still love, I love those paintings, and I realized that in those, there's a lot of heat, and the feet, in other words, the skin of the painting was almost like decaying skin. It had, again, a bag of physicality to it that carried a meaning, but the pictures, even though they were kind of like giants in a screaming baby pictures, they had these feet up, and I thought of them in relationship to the intimacy that you feel with somebody that is ill, you know, that you experience. So for me, I was, you know, I guess like in any kind of trauma, like you're trauma taps into all your traumas, and I think that the kind of experience with David gave me license to kind of go way all the way, like whatever. I felt scared in my studio when I was making those because they were like, but they were also kind of funny and strange, and so I think that kind of fueled me to kind of like do it, whatever it was. And then the other thing was that they were certainly expression of the experience that I had. It, you know, like you can't sort of express something when you're going through it. So I think that over that period of time, the early 90s, a lot of the work was expressive both of that experience, but also as a kind of a trigger to other personal childhood experiences, you know, even, and so to me that work, so in the 90s, I had a kind of a resurgence career-wise. And that's actually how I met Betty, because after Blum Hellman, I showed it Hirschlin Adler when she was still working there. And so I kind of think to myself that it takes me about 10 years to figure out how to move from one piece to the next, you know, so that it, from Jersey City to my studio in the city to making those paintings was really, and also those literally those canvases had been started 10 years before. I mean, they were, you know, like sometimes I think of paintings as being like a, you know, a body, and inside of those bodies, I had been building the organs. And then by the time I got to the skin, it was actually when the painting was finished and then they were exhibited. So
some of the paintings were worked on over a 10-year period.
Right.
Wow. And that exhibit that you're talking about is, was that Blum Hellman or you're talking about the Betty Cunningham?
No. They were first shown at Exit Art, and Exit Art was they were big supporters of me. And the Exit Art show, for some, you know, Irving Blum went and saw it, and he was talking to Jeanette and Papacolo about, I guess he was, you know, Irving is a person that loves to do the search. He's like an, you know, he's the art dealer that loves to go, you know, up the crazy stairs and find the kind of magical moment. So I think he felt like that was me. And in the Exit Art show, they were two giant paintings hanging in the front. I was mentioned in the review. And, you know, it was one of those things where suddenly what makes somebody respond to something, I don't really know. But in those paintings, again, I'll credit David in the sense of saying, like, that there was an urgency to remove any membrane between. I had a girlfriend, a woman came to my studio, and she said to me, you know, this is before I started making the figures in them. They were abstract for a long time. And she said, you know, it's kind of hard to see how hard you work, and yet the paintings are not, you won't bring them up to the surface. Like, you kind of, they're somewhere in there, and I can kind of see it, sort of, but it doesn't. And after that, I just kind of felt like, okay, let me see what they look like. And that was actually the return to the figure. So the kind of parameters of drawing of a figure was sort of sat on top of all this kind of viscous stuff that had been building. And so from those, Irving saw the show, and then I started working with Irving. And then I started, and then I had, I think I may have just had one person show at Blum Hellman. But the thing that, you know, what you touched on, the show at Blum Hellman, which I liked, but it didn't have the 10 years of painting. Like, that's one of the things about commercial success all of a sudden, because I'd actually been working on those paintings so long, and you either have to have a lot of strength of character to say, you know what, I'm going to wait another 2 or 3 years to do this show, or you kind of like, you know, take advantage of the moment. But they didn't have the kind of depth, I think, that those that the paintings that I showed at Exit Art had. They didn't have that kind of resonance. I just didn't have the time to do it, and not just the time, but the understanding of what that what was different between the two. In other words, they look kind of the same, but they just didn't have that depth.
And that was acquired over years of building them. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yes. Over whatever time was necessary in building them, which sometimes was immediate and sometimes was long, but never predicated on having a show. You know what I mean? Like the painting sometimes needs to be quickly done, or and if you think of your work as all being one big continuum, then it's not as though each painting has to have a time clocked in. It's just that none of them had, they were kind of, you know, I guess, again, it's the danger, it's difficult, but it's the danger of the relationship between career and art, because you know, I had this opportunity, and I worked like crazy to make these paintings, but I, for whatever reason, didn't really have the kind of, I was making them, you know, some things can have the look of something else, but they don't have the feel of it. They're sort of sectionalized. They look like it. They look like the, like those other paintings look like something on the surface, but they had been, but they actually also, like I said, they kind of had a pulse of all this stuff that had come before. It's not that the long term gives you that pulse. It's just that I wasn't really saying I'm nurturing these paintings and I'm going to, when they're finished, I'll show them. I was more thinking, fuck, I got a show. I better make 10 paintings.
Right. And then that was around the time where you began teaching, or was that later?
No, I've always taught. I taught always in my, especially in my lean years. I taught at Parsons for 10 years. Then I started teaching. In fact, that would be, I did teach at RISD teaching drawing. The one semester I was also, it was a 1994. But then I would stop teaching because I would be able to, you know, sustain myself. So I've taught, over time, I've taught at a lot of places. And I love teaching. And teaching for me, right now, you know, it gives me a lot. I mean, I guess, like, ideally, probably, if I didn't need the money, I wouldn't teach at all. I would take the time off, because I think being an artist just requires your all of your energy. But the teaching did help me to articulate my ideas, but also, like, I think you learn from your students, and they do, you know, I like teaching at RISD because the kids are so great that you look at what they're doing, and you, like, can just take anything you want from it, because you can, basically, they've got a lot of great ideas that you can pilfer. So. But then, so I did teach, I taught in the East Village. In 84, Mike Bidlow did a big happening at PS1. It was supposed to be, a, you know, the factory that he remade. And I went to, I went on the train to RISD to teach. So I taught there in 84, 94, and now I'm teaching, I teach there too. But I I'll go back in the spring, but I had a year off and I'll go back. I'm just adjunct, always adjunct.
It's very exciting to talk to you. I'm so glad, you know, you discussed a lot of things about the 80s and David, and I think that's very interesting what you were talking about now, and as you entered into the kind of commercial world, or one aspect of it was having to make work in a different way. Is in closing, and I'm hesitant to, you know, to close this because it is so exciting to talk to There's a number of artists listening to this from around the world, and I think that, you know, of all ages, and I think that there's a very powerful message, and particularly what you last said about the pressures of entering the commercial sphere and producing work, you know, based on really a time constraint as opposed to whatever it is that you want to do in your studio over whatever period of time. Do you want to say anything more about that or about something else in terms of how people are entering the art world in what's really a very different time, a very different era now?
Well, you know, sometimes those constraints are really wonderful. And so I have a couple of thoughts. One is that I think of someone like Jasper Johns, who to me is an artist who actually protected his work and never really... The thing about making it for the market to me is just a weakness that I think that over time maybe I can learn to overcome. So I don't think that that's something that everybody has to have. And sometimes, like in the East Village, having to make a lot of work really quickly was great because it actually got me out of my own way. But I, even in terms of my students, like I think that there are, the world is a different place, but my guess is that it, in a way it isn't also. And one of the things I feel like is over time, you know, rather than thinking the world is changing, I think that at all times, all things are happening. So I think for people that are young, I always say, find your own community and try to be creative about how you put work up in the world, because having work in the world exhibited in some way or other, and even among a group of peers, is a way of learning about your own work. And so if you can have the strength of character to say that, you know, you're interested in developing art, and what art means to you is a big thing. It's like, you know, sometimes I'll say, like, it's like learning the violin. It's not just something, it's something complicated. It's something rich for you to, and even to develop your own language and find your own way. And you can have that, and I think sometimes youthful enthusiasm, it comes right out. That kind of stuff is so great. And then maybe sometime in the middle of your life, you know, sort of like I feel like I'm just kind of coming out of a time, but the kind of your 40s where you just kind of maybe hunker down and develop certain things that are the necessary skills for you, and then you kind of reemerge with that kind of youthful enthusiasm again. So I think that people can make the world what they want it to be. I mean, I know that sounds Pollyanna, which I potentially can be, but I think that in any given time, like maybe it's not happening in the East Village, but I bet you it's happening somewhere in some pocket of Brooklyn. You know, it's there are people that are creative and enthusiastic and go see the world. I guess for me to be an artist, and this is, here's my final thing. I used to show a little video of David, and in it, he talked about the artist being an outsider. And there was a point in time when I stopped showing my students, because when he came to that point, they just didn't know what he was talking about. And I thought, wow, okay, so now the artist has become an insider. And that's such a strange thing. Like, to me, the artist has to stand back a little bit to be reflective of the world around them. So I think that if you want to be an insider and you want to make a lot of money, you know, God bless you, but there might be other ways of doing that that are more interesting to me, and that I believe that the definition of artist is not necessarily somebody who participates, you know. Well, I just saw The Wolf of Wall Street, and I hate to think that those people can be artists, the discipline of artist can fall in that category. It would be too devastating to me. So I like to think that there are artists all the time, and those are people that are making things. And in the sense that becomes political, because it becomes more rarefied, the way you said about Betty becoming more special over time, because that becomes a rarer thing. And so it's not as though it's not going to exist. It's just going to be something, you know, what I believe in as an artist becomes more and more particular over time. And that's cool. My students are very excited people, and they'll find their way, because, we're not in a monolithic world. It's the platitude, this is my final thing. Change is constant, so I think that they're there. They're just finding their pockets, finding their way.
Judy, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.